Again, if you, so I know a lot of you were in our first part, and so I don't even have to say this to you, but this class is an absolute waterfall of information. There is no possible way, even an entire summer, I could cover all of church history, much less really just six short little classes. Everything I talk about tonight is probably its own class if you were to go to seminary or something, but we're just doing it quick. So I'm skipping a lot of dates and specific names. Tonight you'll definitely hear some names because there are some really important ones, but I'm not too big of a, like, it's not like, oh, in 14, don't spend a lot of time worrying about that. Everything that I say is almost always a generalization, a kind of big picture. There's always exceptions. I can't talk about church history generally without acknowledging that there's always people doing different things, but we're just talking big picture. One of the things that I want to say right at the beginning, especially for those that weren't here in the first class. So the Christian church started in what is today known as Asia Minor, Greece, Turkey, that area. Specifically, it started in Jerusalem and Israel and quickly spread into the East area. So that was the formation of the church. Eventually, it reached Rome and what we now think today of Western Europe, France, Spain, Germany, we're doing all that. In 1000 AD, is where we ended our last class. The two sort of halves or sides of East and West had basically completely split apart. So picking up in the second millennium, you have an Eastern church and a Western church. Now, you don't need to know a ton about that. Again, if you weren't in the last class, it's okay. The thing I need you to know is you're going to hear me say something a lot, and it's the Western church. So if you're saying, like, West, why does he keep saying Western church? When I say Western church, what I'm referring to is the what eventually would become known as the Roman Catholic Church. That was made up of everything, I guess if you're even into the 80s, everything on this side of the Berlin Wall almost. So all of the Western countries, including, England, France, Spain, all area, and eventually kind of moving into America. The Eastern Church, which is today called the Eastern Orthodox Church, was more of what is today, you know, Russia, Eastern Europe, Asia Minor, that area. So this class specifically almost entirely focuses on what we call the Western Church. Whereas the first 1,000 years, we were kind of talking about both of them together. We're almost moving away. You're not going to spend a lot of time hearing about the East, especially in the first two classes. So we're going to be talking a lot about the Roman Catholic Church, which was the church. Again, for those that weren't with you, the word Catholic means all or universal. So when they called it the Catholic Church, it wasn't a denomination. It was a way of saying we are the church. But they didn't have to call themselves that until they broke in half. And one side said, no, we're the everybody church. You're something else. So the word Catholic sort of started that way. But that's kind of where we're going to be spending a lot of our time, in the West. The West was where the Roman Empire was founded. A lot of our first class dealt with the Roman Empire because that was a big part of Christianity. And so we're going to see that kind of start to come up again in this class. So Rome, Roman Catholic, Western, that's what we're talking about. A lot of our class, this class is going to take place in Germany, and then probably a lot of it in England. So just give you the idea for that. But what we did in our first class is we started right from the beginning, following Jesus' resurrection and ascension to heaven. And within the first 50 or 60 years, you have this movement called Christianity that's taking root. But what was important, and just a reminder for those that were there, and an important thing to know for those that weren't in our first class, for the first 250 years, Christianity was an underground grassroots movement that had no legal rights. It was illegal to be a Christian. You weren't really allowed to serve in the government. It was a difficult, there were many periods of very bad persecution. And then in 300 AD, the Roman Emperor Constantine converted to Christianity and made Christianity legal. And over the span of the next couple hundred years, this small underground grassroots movement that was hiding in caves and things eventually became the legal religion of the Roman Empire, which spread across everything about what was called the known world at that time, outside of maybe like, you know, East, South Asia and East Asia. So the Christian religion took root as a sort of global thing around 400. And for the next 600 years, It just had this trajectory that went from kind of these people downtrodden, poor, oppressed, often illiterate, to the powerful. And that's important to understand. By the turn of the millennium, the church, the Christian community, was a completely different organization than when it was founded 1,000 years earlier. One of the things that happened is with the fall of the Roman Empire, we talked about that during the first class, government collapsed, and it was Christians and Christian leaders who stepped into that fray and said, well, let's hold things together. It was church leaders in Rome that actually kept it going for a few hundred years. Those church leaders eventually rose to prominence, and you eventually had this merging of church and government. At first, it was just sort of a friendship, but by 800, with the crowning of Charles Magne, the great Charlemagne, you had a full merging of church and state as one thing. So if you were living in Western Europe in 900 AD, the church and the state were completely intertwined. The Pope was more powerful than the emperor. And this had quite a few problems. Once the being Pope became essentially being emperor, well, people wanted it for more reasons than just serving Christ, right? So thirst for power, control became calling cards. We saw when church and state really merged, there's just a lot of problems came out of it. I can't reiterate all of them because obviously that would be going back to the whole class. If you want to know more, you weren't here, jump online and listen to it. But all this division, arguing, corruption, it started to pave the way for people to say, this is wrong. There's a problem here. And we're talking about huge swaths of history. Oftentimes, like, we'll have, like, what happened 10 years ago in America? We're talking about 600-700 years at a time. But from about 700 to about 1200 or 1300, about 800 years in there, you had this close tie of the power of the church. Governments bowed to the church. The Pope appointed leaders and rulers. And there was a lot of problems. And it led to a lot of people calling for what would just reform. Like, when you hear the word reform means, like, let's fix it. It needs to be restored. It needs to be brought back to what it's supposed to be. And that's what this whole class is about. So the whole part two is, after 1,300 years, people are now saying, we need to try to fix this and what would come out of that. But before they could actually really reform things, again, I know we're looking at big pictures of history. I mean, to call the church a monolith, I mean, the church controlled everything. Every part of life was controlled by the church. There were no governments that were independent or separate from the church. So even talk about trying to fixing them, how do you even go about fixing this? What do you even say? The people who are in power are the people that are the problem. And they don't just hold power because they control armies. They have the power of your soul and they can condemn you to hell. What do you even do about this? So how would anything ever be fixed and reformed? So we're going to look at a couple things. The first is I want to talk about the seeds of reform. What was the beginning? What was happening that actually led to being able to reform? And so you've got some notes there. Feel free to follow along. Write down whatever you want. It doesn't matter. Just a way to kind of most of them follow the slides here. But I want to talk about three things that changed slowly, not overnight, but changed in the world of Western Europe that brought about the ability for the church to reform. And the first is a huge one. And again, this is definitely building on our last class, but this idea of the rise of knowledge. So when Rome collapsed and people were just sort of left to fend for themselves, you just had tribes and ethnic groups and little warring city-states, everything kind of collapsed. Education kind of went by the wayside. And things just sort of fell apart. And the church sort of stepped in and said, okay, do what we say, we're in charge, don't worry about it. And during this period known as the medieval period, it would eventually be known as the Dark Ages, information, education, intellectual fervor was not a hallmark of society. People didn't go to school. Literacy probably fell below 1%. It was probably closer to 3 to 5% in the Roman Empire, but probably less than 1 out of 100 people could read during this period. And they were ignorant of everything that had come before. So you are sitting right now in a room hearing someone talk about history, tell you things that happened 1,000 years ago. And that's normal, because once you went to school, right? Literally, you sat in school as a kid and they taught you history. You have a general idea about the past. You might forget dates and names, but generally speaking, you kind of know. Imagine having none of that for hundreds and hundreds of years. Growing up in a village that nobody could read, nobody was educated, nobody knew anything about history and wasn't teaching you anything. what's even true? If someone would say Rome, you'd be like, Rome, I think that, well, didn't Rome used to be in charge or something? I don't know, right? No concepts of science, no concepts of education. In that vacuum, religion is everything. And whatever the church says, that's true. The church tells them it's true. So not having the ability to know things yourself creates, well, you've heard the phrase, knowledge is power, right? And so we saw at the end of part one, this created a path where it was easy for superstition, weird ideas that we look back on and say, like, what? Where did you get that? Well, they got that because no one was studying anything. No one knew anything. They just kind of make things up. And the power of the church grew and grew because that church leader in your town told you what was true and he believed him. Guess what? He couldn't read either. He didn't even have a Bible. So this started to shift, though, in the 11th and 12th centuries. And there's a few reasons why it started to shift. And the stuff I'm about to say isn't super important. Like, I got to know this. But I want to just give you some background about why it started to shift. One reason it started to shift is if in the first class we talked about the rise of monasticism, the monks. Monks were people who wanted to leave society because they felt society was corrupt and Rome took power and church and government and all this stuff. They just wanted to get away from it and go and study and live in monasteries apart from the world. And we kind of talked about, was that good or bad? You know, well, something interesting happened. When everything had started to fall apart and more of the church and government was just corrupt and gross, the monks actually started coming back into society. And they stopped just sort of staying alone. They actually felt they needed to come back into society and make a difference. So you had the rise of something called mendicants. And again, a mendicant monk was different than a normal monk because they believed that they weren't supposed to just stay in their little safe space, but they were supposed to go into the world and make a difference. You had two basic kinds of mendicants, but all of them held a general agreement. They read Jesus' words literally, like, sell everything, don't take anything with you, just go and preach the gospel. And so they would literally just travel around and go from town to town and however they could help. They reached out to people in poverty, preaching on, you know, they just get on boxes and talk to people, just ask for enough money to survive. So this began to be a very common thing. And there were two groups. The first was the Franciscans off of St. Francis of Assisi. Again, I could do a whole class on him. He was amazing. He was a rich kid who sold everything and he went and lived in extreme poverty. And people followed him. His thing was like, we as Christians should be caring for the poor. We shouldn't be involved in politics, worrying about just love people and care for people. And so he had a whole following of Franciscans that would follow his example. You've probably seen him in movies, you know, Robin Hood and what was it, Friar Tuck that followed him around. He was a mendicant monk. But while the Franciscans really were focused on helping the poor, there was another group of mendicant monks who had a different view. They followed a guy named Dominic. And the Dominicans believed that they were supposed to go and fight heresy. So these were guys who could read, who were, you know, they had whole traditions of being in their monasteries, studying the few books that were surviving. And they looked out in society and saw all this crazy superstition and people weird, like we should go tell them the truth. So the Dominicans would actually start going around Europe, teaching people and be like, that's not true. That's not who God really is. Let me explain it to you. And this became kind of a thing where like, even like the local priest would be like, oh, hey, tell me what's true. Like, you can read, what does this say, right? So these Dominican monks really started to create a sense that there's knowledge out there. But again, the reason they had it was because during this medieval period, when everything was falling apart, they actually stored all these books and things in their monasteries, and they were the few that could actually read. So now in the 11th and 12th century, as they're going back out into the world, they're bringing knowledge with them. And they would be the beginning stages of, they founded universities. So the first actual college of Oxford was founded by Dominicans. Every university in the world up until recently was founded by Christians Western, not Eastern, was founded by Christians based on these ideas. So further education, growing your knowledge, all that kind of stuff. There's another thing that happened, which was we talked in the first class about the Crusades. So the Crusades, and we're not going to get back in and go, you can go listen to it. Basically, all of these knights and all the people with them go east, travel through the eastern part of the old empire to get down to Jerusalem, wage war, and then all come back. off and on for almost 250 years. Well, before the Crusades, there was no contact with the East. Like, you're talking not that far away, but really completely broken apart. So if you lived in the area today that might be currently Spain, like let's just say you were a person that lived in a hovel in Spain, you knew nothing about what's today Turkey or Greece or East Africa. That was a different world that you knew anything about, even though you used to be one church, completely separated. Then all these people start going back there for the Crusades and then start coming back. And they bring with them all this information that the West hadn't had in 600 or 700 years. They bring books written by early Eastern church fathers, copies of scripture that were actually in the original language. If you lived in Western Europe in 1100, the only Bible anywhere in your vicinity would be a copy of the Latin Vulgate, which was a copy from the 4th century. It wasn't a great copy. You had no idea how to read Greek. You'd never seen a Greek Bible. So to you, the Latin Bible was all you had. Nobody knew or understood Greek, and that Greek was what the Bible was written in. Now, following the Crusades, suddenly you've got all these Greek Bibles and stuff coming back, and the Dominicans are like, wait, what is this? What does this say? And you're questioning, you're starting to read things for yourself. And this began the rise of something that would become known as scholasticism, where we get our word scholastic or scholarly. Scholasticism was this growth and development of education. So the people are like, we need to get out of this. We need to start learning. We need to start teaching our kids. We need to go and find information. So rather than crusades, they were actually, people would travel to the East just to find books and bring them back. They rediscovered philosophy for the first time in hundreds of years. Aristotle and Plato and different people that, like today, are like, oh, we know about them, but they were basically lost to the West for a long time. And so you had the rise of some really intelligent men and women who began to ask questions about what is and isn't true. The first and most famous one was a guy named Anselm of Canterbury. Anselm, in 1050, he made this famous statement of faith seeking understanding, fidea cognito. I want to understand. But his point was, he was saying, I believe all this stuff. I was raised in the church. I hear the Pope. I've been taught and I believe it, but it doesn't make any sense. I want to understand it. I want to actually reason it out for myself. And Anselm became kind of the father of what would be a whole branch of people that said, is what we believe even reasonable, or are we just believing silly superstition? And as knowledge increased, you had great arguments about reason and logic, and philosophy really started to take root in the West. You had a big argument between, and this goes back to our first class, they began to rediscover Plato and Aristotle, and Aristotle was somebody that had really been lost to history. But he was very different from Plato, if you've heard those words before. Plato was a mystic. He believed in sort of metaphysical things and spiritual things and other realities. Aristotle was maybe today more what you'd call a scientist. He's like, no, hard facts, believe things. Plato's views had dominated the church in the West. So sometimes you might hear things from, well, you know, back in the Middle Ages, Christians believed this. You're like, what in the world? Everything was metaphysical. Everything was demons and angels and heaven and hell, which some of that's still a big part of our religion. I'm not saying it's not, but everything was metaphysical. There was anything that happened in the world during the Dark Ages happened because there was a demon or, you know, lightning. Oh, the gods is angry, right? It's like they completely reverted almost to like ancient humans in some ways. And now you had people saying, wait a second, hold on. Like, let's literally think about this. Aristotle says we can actually study and learn things. And another name, again, I know I'm throwing a lot of names at you, I'm sorry, but one of the most famous was a man named Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas was a guy who took Anselm a step further, and he said, like, there must be a relationship between faith and reason. Like, there must be a middle ground where we can use our brains to make sense of this and not just believe whatever we're being told, and we can actually study things, right, but also still have faith. Now, I know I just threw a lot of stuff at you. A lot of names, like, who's this? Here's the most important thing you understand about everything I just said. The first major shift that began to happen around this time was that people began thinking for themselves, right? People began thinking for themselves. And that hadn't been the case in about 800 years. When people start thinking for themselves, that's when you can begin challenging old regimes and authority, right? The reason that most often, whether it's this situation or any tyrant or bad government, usually takes power is because people stop thinking for themselves. When knowledge and understanding go away and people just buy into whatever, that's when you can control people. And with the influx of new information, new knowledge, people studying and learning and reading again, they sort of set the groundwork to be like, okay, well, wait a minute, who put you in charge? Right? You see this begins to happen here. Now, along with this, another big, you might have probably heard this word, I'm sure you're some of you are back in high school, history class, sorry. But as all this began to happen, people began to learn and study more. Like people who really didn't know anything about ancient Greece and Rome, now we're seeing and reading these books. And Rome became the cool thing. Like the ancient world suddenly was like that was when humanity was at its peak. We need to get back to that. And so it became sort of in vogue in Western Europe to try to be like Rome again. They used Roman words and things. And this became known as a period of time called the Renaissance. Where they looked at the Greeks and how they loved art and literature and classic study. And in East Western Europe, it was cool now to be educated and to learn and to try to do things that romanticized the ancient cultures. It's actually during this period that they named the previous 800 years the Dark Ages, because now the Renaissance, light is now shining on us again. We're now intellectual, we're intelligent once again. Forget those last 800 years when everything was dark and horrible. And this really was a whole movement of society that would bring about great change. Obviously, the two of the huge things that would come out of this would be the scientific revolution. You had people actually asking questions about nature and studying it for themselves, which would just create a boom of understanding of nature. Famous scientists and physicists, Isaac Newton and others. You'd also have what became known as the Industrial Revolution would be birthed out of this. For the longest time, the economy was a few rich people that owned all the land and everybody else just working it as serfs. It was a feudal system. Now you start to have a rise of a middle class, of people becoming merchants and finding other educated jobs and sort of not just living in poverty, but not just controlling it. A whole rise of this group of people who were now sort of educated, had some money, had some freedom, had their own thoughts. This set the groundwork for power systems to be challenged. Of course, the most important thing to many people during this period was an invention by a guy named Gutenberg. Gutenberg invented movable press, which allowed you, if a person wanted to take the Book of Romans and copy it and make a copy of it, it would take an average monk probably a month to copy it, and it would be something to buy that copy of Romans would probably cost you 2 or 3 weeks' wages just to own that one letter. To buy a Bible would be crazy, and a Bible would be like that thick, and it would be all hand-scripted, full of errors. Gutenberg changed everything, because now you could take a copy of Romans and go, pop, 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 here's 10,000. And people are able to read it. So literacy is up, and now they can read. So now, if I have an idea or something's going on in my head and I want to tell you about it, it's not just me talking to these 10 people. I can write it and have it printed and spread it around the entire world. This was sort of the first internet age, if you will. This happened in 1439. The official Reformation would happen about 50 years, 60 years later, not coincidentally. The Gutenberg Press was a huge part of it. You also had something called humanism rise to the surface, which, again, all related to Renaissance, classical learning, philosophy, what's good for humankind. Men like Da Vinci and Michelangelo, all these kind of people. Culture, it's all rising to the surface. Now, if you leave here and you don't remember all that stuff, it doesn't matter. That's not the point. I was more just giving you. What I want you to see, though, is when they're in the dark, they believe everything they're told. That's human nature, right? When we step out of the dark, we have some money, we have some knowledge, we have the ability to talk to each other. Then those people that are telling us what's true were suddenly like, is that true? This worked to challenge the old ways, authoritative structures. Why should I do this? Because the Pope said so. Okay. Now, why should I do this? Because the Pope said so. Did he? What? How does he know? Right? This is beginning to happen. People are reading the Bible for themselves. Priests who never even saw a Bible were now able to get a copy of the Bible in their local parish, their local town, because of the press. And this began to change what society looked like. For 800 or 900 years, people had just gone along with whatever. Whatever the church said, that's what's believed. Okay, fine, I'll do it. It began to change the rise of knowledge. But along with the rise of knowledge, there's something else that changed. And this is, I'm only going to tell you this because it kind of comes into play later in our story. It's a little confusing, but I'll try to make it clear. This increase in learning and knowledge and understanding, something else came with it. And it wasn't just about religion. It wasn't just my views of the church are changing. Also, the view of government began to change at this point. The view of, like, what does it mean to be ruled, to be led, to be part of a society? All of this began to change. And many of the things that, as Americans, are part of our system of thought and Bill of Rights began to be formatted in this time by people who really began to question. But before democracy ever came on the scene, something else came on the scene which would really sort of change everything. Today, if you meet someone who is a non-American, a question you might ask is where you're from, and their answer will be a country, right? They'll say, I'm from Mexico or Canada or Lithuania, right? That's because that's our world. We live in countries. And because we live in countries, we often kind of think in our heads, well, that's just the way it is. But it wasn't always that way. When I say things like, if you lived in Spain in 1080, Spain didn't exist in 1080. In 1000 AD, it was just a big mass of land. And what you had was you had people groups all over those masses of land. And some of them were really closely connected. Some of them fought with each other. They warred with each other. They had names that sound familiar, like Franks, who would eventually form this thing they called France. Britons, they formed Britain. Like, but they were just people groups. They were just ethnic groups that lived in different places and traveled around. There was nothing saying, like, there's this nation and this nation. That begins to happen now. This thing we call nationalism. Nationalism is this idea that instead of everyone just sort of living wherever and all of us looking to the Pope, now I actually sort of start to draw borders and see myself as part of a country. And so instead of just being like, well, I'm just a person that lives around here and I'm a part of the church or whatever, now it's like, no, I'm a German, right? I'm Portuguese. What does that mean? I'm English. You're English. Like, to identify yourself by a country was a shift that happened at this time. And in doing so, when people began to identify themselves by their nationality, it had major political implications, because now I'm not warring with you just because we're different clans. Now it's like, well, we have different kings, and that's our, this line right here is our land, that's your land. But you also began to have this issue of like, well, where does the church play now when it's not just one big land mass, but it's actually individual countries? And every little country has its own king, and we all have our own desires and wants. What happens when we start fighting each other? Which side does the church take, right? And so this idea of individual nations, people started to feel more independent. They started to say to themselves, like, I don't know what the church has to say, but I know what Germans say, right? That became a real thing. In fact, nationalism in Germany would lead to some other problems. That's a different class. It made less and less sense to look to some overarching power, right? The idea of an emperor grew less and less. Like, over time, people were like, an emperor? What are you talking about? We don't need an emperor. We're England. We're fine by ourselves. But along with that, it was like, well, why do we need to support Rome? Who's Rome? Rome's Italian. We're not Italian. Who's this Pope? So over as it began to happen, the voice of the Pope got weaker and weaker. He lost some power. A massive fight broke out between two countries, England and France, and it lasted literally for 100 years. It became known as the Hundred Years' War. And during the Hundred Years' War, the Pope sided with France. So for 100 years, if you're English, your enemy is the French. And the French are like super into the Pope, and the Pope loves them. How do you feel about the Pope? The Pope's not for England, he's for France, right? That would actually set the stage for a major turning point in world history, simply because people began to see the Pope as maybe part of a different country and not part of their country, a massive shift in the way people thought. So the rise of knowledge, the rise of nationalism, and then, of course, building on what I've already said, you had just the continued rise of corruption. In many ways, the biggest cause of reform in the church was the church itself, its own problems, the leaders of the church. Even with all the other issues happening in the world, the greatest and most glaring issue was that the church was just a mess. As the papacy, being the pope, once it became the most powerful position in the world, it was not godly men who sought it. It was power-hungry, greedy people who fought for it. So much so that these guys would constantly war with each other to the point that at one point they elected, like, two popes got elected. Like, people hated one pope and they elected a new one. And they was like, I'm a pope, you can't elect a new one. And they excommunicated each other. And like, which pope do we follow? They started fighting each other. Eventually they called a council. Like, we're getting rid of both you guys and we're gonna elect a third one. Guess what happened? You had three popes and they were all horrible people. And each pope preferred his own nation. And so those nations started warring with each other. They all had their own political agenda. And so this just became more and more of a problem. And for much of the time, the leaders who are responsible for the souls of people were just spending all their time worrying about politics and wealth and money. And it clearly undermined their message. So if their message, the powerful, is being undermined, and these monks who are walking around giving me money and caring for the sick are actually in my life, who do I start listening to more? Right? Who has more influence over me? Right? So it was those mendicant monks who were traveling. Their message became the dominant message. So when their message started to be, you know what? That guy's full of crap. Don't listen to him. People listened. A major event happened called the bubonic plague. It was the Black Death. When I look at numbers of the bubonic plague, it's almost like mind-numbing. A third of Europe died. Guys, we went crazy over COVID. A third of Europe. One out of every three human beings died of a plague. Like, that means like every single family in Europe buried somebody, if not multiple people, if not their entire family. A third of the population in the 1300s. It brought massive famine because there weren't enough farmers to care for the land. It just ruined everything. And people were desperate. They were searching for hope and answers. What do we do? Pope, what do we do? I'm rich. I don't need to worry about you. Yeah. Friars, what do we do? And these mendicants were staying with the people and dying of the plague themselves. And when people were desperate for answers and they only see corruption at the top, eventually you just, I'm done with this, right? Yeah. And of course, as they fought and warred with each other, as these popes are warring for power, who's in charge? Well, you got to pay for that, right? As these popes want a really nice, fancy life and fancy clothes, where do you get the money for it? Well, you start something called a church tax, and you make people pay taxes to the church. Why? Well, that's not enough money. So how about this? I have the power as the pope, all the way back from Peter, I've been blessed by it, to actually ensure that you get to heaven when you die. And I'll make sure if, right? And so this idea we talked about a little bit called indulgences. So they didn't fully believe that a pope could get you out of hell. If you died and went to hell, you were done. But most people who were, as long as you were baptized, I don't have time, if you were baptized in the Catholic Church as a baby and you died, you were part of the church. But what if you never were like a good person? Like, what if you were like a really horrible, horrible human being, but you were baptized as a baby? Do you just get to go right to heaven? Well, that doesn't make sense. I don't think God would do that. You know what I bet? I bet there's like a place you go to before heaven where you have to kind of like pay your dues because you're such a horrible person. Then you get to go to heaven. You can't go to hell because you're part of the church, but you're a really bad person. So they created this thing called purgatory, which was a place that you would go to basically pay your fine. And however horrible of a person you were is how long you had to spend in purgatory. Now you might be asking yourself, that's an interesting concept. Where is that in the Bible? Nowhere. How'd they make it up? I don't know. Why do people believe it? Because they didn't have a Bible. So the Pope said it's purgatory. Okay, I'm in purgatory. Well, how do you get out of purgatory? You got to pay your dues. Is there another way? Well, the Pope can get you out. So the Pope would actually create little pieces of paper, officially stamped, that said, the owner of this officially gets their uncle out of purgatory. And how do you get one? You give them money. So the church started selling the ability for you to get out of purgatory, which is great, right? And this would actually, so corruption, nationalism, and the rise of knowledge, all of this is happening at the same time. And it would set the stage for a rumbling, for a, this has got to change. So we sort of set the seeds, and now around the 1300s or so is when people start to actually talk. When some of these friars and monks and people are like, wait a second, other leaders begin to speak up a little bit. You know, as I mentioned again in part one, and I'm painting these big, broad strokes, right? It's not to say there were ever any people speaking up. I'm sure there were. We don't know about it because, number one, they couldn't, anyone speaking up couldn't write, right? So all that we know about history is what's been written down, and the winners tend to write things down. And so there's a long period of time that nobody that was opposed to the Catholic Church got written down or saved. Most of our writings come during this period when people actually started doing their own writing apart from the church. So there probably were people. The other thing is, when you have absolute power and you like your power and you enjoy your power and somebody challenges your power, if you're, you know, the kind of person who sought power the wrong way, you're probably going to accuse them of being a heretic and light them on fire and burn them, which happened all the time. So most of the people that said things about the church got burned. So we don't have a lot. But now things are changing. The overall power of the church has weakened. There's room now to start voicing your opinion. There's some places to say, like, hold on. You're Italian. I'm German. The German king is gonna has my back. I'm going to say what I want to say. First time in history you can start doing that kind of stuff. But before we really got that, there were a few guys that were good voices that didn't quite make it. I want to introduce you to two of them. Again, you don't need to remember all this, but I think it's just helpful. The first and probably most famous was an Englishman, one of the few people who would have used that term early on. His name was John Wycliffe. You ever heard the Wycliffe Bible or the Wycliffe Society? Wycliffe was just a fireball of a human being who would go. He was kind of like one of these mendicants who would just go town to town. He would like literally get like stand on a box or something and just start preaching to people. And Wycliffe was notorious for calling out the church leaders. He studied at Oxford. He was very intelligent, and he gained a lot of popularity for preaching against the Pope and against corruption, all this kind of stuff. He taught that, he's like, guys, look at the Bible. It says that a servant or a leader should be a servant. Someone who represents Christ should act like Christ. Look at the way Christ acted in the Bible. And all the people said, oh, we don't know what you're talking about. We can't read the Bible. So Wycliffe's like, he went and translated the Latin Bible into English. That was the first time you had a Latin Bible in a non-language. Well, the people who controlled the Bible thought that was a sin. Or they just were worried that was going to undermine their power, one or the other, but that was a big deal. So they did everything that any time anyone found a Wycliffe English Bible, it got burned immediately. But you had the Gutenberg press just making more and more and more, and it began to spread. Wycliffe was actually responsible for the development of modern English language. You don't even know that. So he was a big challenger of this. And again, his main contribution, though, was the first person to say Scripture should be for the people. You and I, as post-Reformation human beings, accept that. Like, of course, Scripture's for the people. This is radical. He was one of the first voices. He would stand up and say, all of you guys should have the Bible yourselves. It shouldn't just be that guy with the funny hat. You should have a Bible, and you should read it. And I'm going to give it to you. And he did. They convicted him of being a heretic, but unfortunately, he passed away before they could burn him. So guess what they did? They dug up his bones and burned his bones. Because that's what Christians do. But before he died, he had started a movement. His followers were called the Lollards because they had a, like they mumbled when they prayed. It was a negative term, but the Lollards were some of the early formations of future Reformation movements. And over the next few centuries, these were the people who started getting their own Bibles. Once people started getting their own Bibles and reading it for themselves, that's when everything started to change. So Wycliffe was so important because translating the Scriptures into an ability for you and I to read it, now it's really up. Now we're like, wait a second. You've been teaching my whole life. What? That's not in here, right? Everything starts to change. Another important guy was John Huss. If you've heard of John Huss, maybe you haven't. He didn't make it. He was one of the most famous people. So John Huss would do the same thing. He would go around and preach out in open air stadiums, not stadiums, but he'd walk into a town and preach outside. And he would often condemn the church and its leaders and say, like, not the church, but the leaders, the corruption. He'd speak against, you can't sell indulgences. All the popes are corrupt. And they wanted to figure out how to shut him up. So they passed a rule. The Pope and his cardinals passed a law saying the word of God cannot be preached outside of a church building, because that's biblical. So they did it just to shut him up, which, of course, he didn't. He's like, no, the word of God should be in every person's hands. Everybody should hear it. You shouldn't have to. No one can tell me where I can and can't preach the word of God. I wanted to say that now, because before all the other stuff, that doesn't happen. Before other people are able to actually read the Bible with him and hear him, before there's already this undergirding, this movement. John Huss was someone who benefited from being taught how to read and being given a Bible. And now he's able to go out and say this. So it starts with the rise of knowledge, the rumblings, and then you have these people who start standing up. Of course, they tried him for heresy, for preaching outside, and they burned him at a stake. They burned him at the stake for preaching outside. Many would say that Huss was kind of one of the breaking points. His followers, who became known as the Hussites, eventually formed the foundations of what would later be the modern-day Reformation. But this was kind of a point that when Huss got burned, it's a very famous point in history, because now people are getting angry. Like, people are getting upset. This is ridiculous. They killed John Huss. And more people began questioning the system, especially as the popes got worse and worse. You had this guy named Leo X. Leo X was, if you've ever heard of the Medicis, the most powerful Italian rich family, he was the Medici. And it was just anybody that knew any, like, he didn't even know, he clearly bought the title, like, he bought it. Like, he paid a bunch of people and they made him Pope. And Leo X was just, I don't know, if, in history speaking, like, not like a horrible, like, evil human being, but just a guy who was just rich and powerful and loved money and loved stuff. And Leo X had a vision to build the world's most beautiful church. And because he was the Pope and he was the descendant of Peter, he wanted to call it St. Basilica of Peter, St. Peter's Basilica, the Church of Peter. And it would be the most beautiful thing. And Leo X would be known as the guy who built the world's most beautiful church. But he had to pay for it. So let's sell some indulgences. And Leo X and his sale of indulgences would be the final straw that would start what became known as the Reformation. You guys okay? We're making good time, but I didn't give breaks last time, and I didn't know if people regretted it. I mean, I got about a half hour left. Is anyone like dying, or do you want me to keep going? You can always get up and don't feel it. If you gotta, I'll just keep going. Maybe we'll get out early. Okay, so the Reformation, the dawn of the 16th century, so 1500s, about 500 years ago. We actually celebrated Reformation Day 5 years ago. The 500th anniversary was 5 years ago, 1517. This is when this thing we call the Reformation took place. Now, we call it the Reformation, even though reform is a verb, to reform something. The Reformation is really marked by a specific event that happened in history. But that event had ripples, and it would, you know, even today it's still rippling out. But when I say the Reformation, I'm referring to an event. When we just talk about reform, we're talking about all different kinds. When we talk about Reformation or reforming the church, there were two views, okay? And this is all beginning to happen at this time. Some people were called magisterial reformers. And you think that word magisterial, power, majesty. They believed that the church was inherently good, that the Catholic Church was the Catholic Church. There's one church. But the problem is our leaders are corrupt, and they're doing some things they shouldn't do. So reform means we need to fix the problems with the church, okay? So that was a common view among many people. We need to fix the problems in the church. But there was another view that was a bit different. They became known as radical reformers. Radical reformers said, no, the whole system's broken. The Catholic Church, it's all nonsense. It's all broken. We need to blow the whole thing up and start something new. It's not just corruption or bad leadership. The whole overarching idea of church as we've created it is not God's will. They don't want to reform. They want a clean break. And both ideas are surging at the time. Someone like Wyclef or John Huss would have been magisterial reformers. They didn't want to blow up the church. They just wanted to fix it. But now in the 15th century, you have some people saying, you know what? I think the whole thing's garbage. And there would be a spark that would happen. And that spark began with Leo X, his desire to build this massive temple, this massive church to St. Peter. And it would have an impact on a young monk by the name of Martin Luther. So I know I've given you a lot of names. When you leave tonight, I hope he's at least the name you remember the most. Martin Luther is known as the father of the Reformation. He's probably next to someone like maybe St. Augustine, probably the most famous, important figure in church history, for sure over the last 1,500 years. So let's talk about Martin Luther a little bit. He was born in the late 1400s, and about a decade before Columbus set sail for America. So that's where we're talking here. And the last of the Muslims were being kicked out of Europe. And Martin Luther was a very intelligent, brilliant young man, extremely, extremely outspoken, sometimes bordering on rude. If you know anything about the Enneagram, Martin Luther was an 8. He was a go-getter. He was one of those people, kind of a bull in a china shop type guy. His father was a poor miner and a peasant. And his father wanted him to study, go to university and study, because that's how you get a good life. So his father spent tons of his adult life scrimping and saving just so he could send his son Luther to school. And Luther instead chose to become a monk, which didn't make his dad happy. But what I want you to understand is why Luther became a monk. Because why Luther became a monk would be a huge deal. Like many in his day, and we know a lot about Luther because he wrote tons of stuff down. We know his whole life. Luther was obsessed with spiritual things, evil spirits, witches, ghosts. Someone's like, wait, he's a Christian? Oh, yeah, he believed in witches, ghosts, all of it. And while traveling through the woods one night, he got caught in a storm. And in the storm, and I don't know, when you think going through the woods, the, you know, different time period, he thought that God was sending evil spirits to kill him. And so he got on his knees and he prayed. He says, God, if you will spare me, if you just let me live through tonight, I will give up everything and I'll become a monk and I'll go and serve you. And the storm passed apparently and he's okay. So his dad, I'm going to become a monk. And he didn't do it because he had this, you know, burning heart desire to serve Jesus. The reason that he did it was because his entire life he had been taught that God was angry. God is vengeful. God sends evil spirits to torment you. If you don't please God, he's going to hurt you, right? He grew up in this conventional Catholic system, the belief that you know, it's either hell or purgatory, you know? You're either going to hell or you're going to suffer for a while after death. Only the saints went straight to heaven. God was angry. You have to work hard to please God. You got to do all the things the church tells you to do. You can't make mistakes. You got to make confession constantly in order to be saved or buy an indulgence. Luther didn't like the idea of grace didn't mean anything to Luther. He just saw anger. When he saw the words law or righteousness, it was like this angry judge up on a stage ready to throw lightning bolts. And he would even say, like at that point of his life, his feeling toward God was something between fear and just downright hatred. Like he hated God. And so he actually joined a monastery almost like because like an angry father was forcing him to, basically. That was his view. One thing we see, and this helps us understand Catholics a bit, today Catholics often have this tradition of praying to Mary or other saints. And one thing that we don't fully understand because we don't see the world the way someone like Luther did, especially St. Anne, Luther would pray to St. Anne to protect him from Jesus. And many times in that time, people would pray that Jesus would hold back God's wrath. Like, Jesus, please don't let God kill me. Like, Jesus was like the middleman to keep you from getting smitten by God. You forget the whole Trinity, Jesus is God. They didn't think about that. And sometimes Jesus was, like, not even the one to go to. So some of the saints, They're up there with Jesus. Hey, will you tell Jesus to protect me so God doesn't kill me? Well, if you really want Jesus' attention, if you want him to care about you, a little nobody, who's the best person to talk to? His mom. Yeah. Pray to Mary and ask Jesus to protect you from God. That's what religion had come to. And here's Luther dealing with all of this. How, he once said, could any of this be called good news? So in fear, he left everything. He joined the monastery. And he just thought, this is going to be a life sentence. I'm going to die in misery. But he was super diligent about it. Just go at it. He'd do everything he's supposed to do. And he was miserable. He was depressed all the time. You know, the first time he gave Mass, he fainted because he was so scared that God was, he was going to do it wrong and God would punish him. And during this time, there's like a priest that was sort of his mentor, saw this and was trying to figure out how to help Luther. And we know a little bit about him, but he said, Luther, maybe what you need to do is, why don't you just go to school and just, you know, I hear they have Bibles there. Go and read it for yourself. Learn it. Maybe it'll be good for your mind or something. So Luther agreed. And he said, okay. So he left the monkhood and he went to a university and he studied. He learned Greek and Hebrew and began to study for himself. And eventually he became such an amazing scholar. They made him a professor at a school called Wittenberg. So he became a teacher at Wittenberg. And there was the first time he ever actually opened the Bible himself. Imagine that. He was a monk and he never opened the Bible. In his late 20s, it was the first time he ever saw a Bible that wasn't chained down. Crazy. So he knew he needed to read it for himself, but only those in the doctoral program could actually get their hands on it. So he joined the program, and he found when he opened this book, it was the only Bible in the whole area, whenever he'd open it, there'd just be notes all over it scribbled. And he began to look at the notes, and he began to realize that so many of the things that he had been taught were not in the book. They were in the notes written around it. And he was like, what in the world? Like, wait a minute. And he was really wrestling with this. The big kicker for him, and this is going to get theological for a second. The big kicker came for him in reading the book of Romans. Luther is famously like Romans was his thing. And he got to the book of Romans. And in the first chapter of the book of Romans, there's a sentence. And this is the thing about words. Some of you guys know me. You come to my classes because you like this. Other of you hate it. I'm interested in words because of the power they hold. So Luther had a Latin Bible. The Bible is not written in Latin. People who spoke Latin tried to translate Greek into Latin, and sometimes they weren't good at it. In chapter 1 of Romans, verse 16 and 17, it begins to talk about this idea of the gospel of Jesus. And in verse 18, there's this shift where Paul moves to talk about essentially the state of the world. You're probably familiar with it. Luther had spent the only time he ever read the Bible and heard the Bible taught, when they read Romans 1:18, they said the wrath of God is being poured out from heaven against us. Now hear that. The wrath of God is being poured out. Right? Luther actually now spoke Greek. And because of the Crusades, he had a Greek Bible. And he looked at it and he saw the wrath of God is being apocalypto from heaven. Now, the word apocalypto is the word that we translate revelation, to reveal or to show something. And Luther looked at this, and he had this moment where he said, wait a second. The wrath of God isn't being poured out. God's not throwing lightning bolts. It's being shown. It's being revealed because it already exists. And Luther said, he's not punishing. He's actually showing us that all of our brokenness is a result of our rejection of him. He's not an angry God who's trying to kill me. He's a loving God who's trying to help me. One word, poured out, is the Latin translation of a word that obviously means revealed, not poured out. So any good English Bible today will say the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven. And so this is a major issue for him. He talks about it a lot, about how just in this moment, he felt like his whole life was changed. His whole view of God shifted from this angry being in the sky who wants to destroy me and all the power of the popes who are just looking at me to, no, this is a God of love and grace who wants good things for me. And it changed his whole view of Christianity. At the same time, he lived in Germany. The Prince of Germany, a guy named Albert of Brandenburg, wanted to purchase a big piece of land owned by the church. And he had to go ask the owner of that land, a guy named Leo the X. And Prince Albert said, hey, will you let me buy this land? Leo said, sure, I'll sell it to you. But have you heard about this church I'm building? So he gave Prince Albert a quota of indulgences that had to be sold in Germany. He's like, if you sell this many indulgences, I'll sell you the land. So Prince Albert was like, all right, sell all the indulgences you want. And there was a man that was hired named John Tetzel. Again, you don't know his name, but John Tetzel was a priest. He seemed like from history, probably an okay guy. He didn't know any different. His job was to go town to town and stand in the street corner. Everybody, I'm here to tell you today that you can get out of purgatory. And he had a saying, like, every time a coin clinks in the box, a soul is released from purgatory. And people just line up and drop their money. Like, bless you, bless you, bless you. I mean, I just see this guy like with like a perfect like suit and tie and big white teeth, ready to go to his jet, you know. And Martin Luther is standing, seeing this, and he's just done. He's just angry. He's a bull. He just flips out. So he just sees Tetzel selling this stuff, and he's like, I'm done with this. So Martin Luther goes home in 1517, and he gets out a piece of paper, and he writes down on this piece of paper 95 things that just piss him off. He calls them theses, but they were just things that piss him off. Like, he writes down 95 things that he thinks are just wrong with the church. And the next day, they were going to be gathering in Wittenberg, a bunch of scholars, for a yearly thing they did where they'd get together and just talk. So he goes to the door at Wittenberg, and he nails these theses to the door, basically saying, hey, guys, when we meet this week, I want to talk about this stuff. I'm upset. I'm just angry. I can't believe that this guy's out there stealing money from kids, all this nonsense. Well, something had already changed. One of the things that had changed was there was already people that were grumbling. There were plenty of people just waiting for someone to say it, you know? It was like when the emperor has no clothes, and they're just waiting for someone to be like, wait a second. The other thing was, you know how to print press. So somebody takes his theses, prints them, and just starts spreading them all over the place. And this would begin the Reformation. Some of his things were basically like, challenging the Pope's power to forgive sins. Like, the Pope doesn't have that power. He can't remove that. It was believed that the priest can restore you to God with confession. But he's like, no, it's only your own, it's God forgiving you. He challenged indulgences. He said, wait a second. And this is one of his theses was this. If the Pope has the power to get you out of purgatory, shouldn't he do it because he's a good person and not for money? If he's really a servant of Christ, guess what? The Pope didn't like that. But the seeds of reform had been set in, and you couldn't just burn it. It was now spreading. This document was just going all over the place. You had a culture growing in knowledge and literacy. The printing press is putting it everywhere. You had nationalism on the rise. A lot of German people were ready to say, we don't need a Pope. Let's do our own thing. The time was ripe for these questions taken seriously. And right off the bat, this affected indulgences. Like John Tetzel, he totally missed his quota. The church got put on hold. And the Prince of Germany is like, what's going on? I don't want my land. Who is this guy? What's happening? The Pope's like, who is this guy? Why is my money not coming in? And so the Pope sends a couple of different people to go and question Luther and challenge him on his beliefs. But every time a cardinal or someone would come, they would come back to the Pope and say, he knows the Bible better than I do. I don't have anything to say. Because he did. Most of the guys he sent couldn't even read it. They'd be like, you said this. He's like, well, it's right here in the Greek. Like, no, right? So they couldn't do anything about him. And he just began to get so popular. Because, like, he was one of these people that was helping the poor and caring for others. And the people were rising up and supporting him. So obviously the Pope's not done with this. It part of his movement, actually, he began to call on the German nobles to throw off the oppression of Rome. So like Luther had a political side to him. So during this time, remember the rise of nationalism, there still was an emperor, a Holy Roman Emperor. And he was a German. At this time, there's just all this political stuff happening. So the Pope essentially wants to call Luther to the table, convict him of heresy, and get rid of him. So they charge him with heresy and call him to come present himself at what became known as the Diet of Worms. Leo excommunicated him, and Luther took the papal bull and burned it publicly and said, I don't care, I don't respect your authority. So They called him to account at the Diet of Worms to stand before the emperor and recant. Charles V is the new emperor. He's a young guy, probably 19 years old or so. He was the king of Spain, and he's a devout Catholic. He's heading up the council, and so everybody thought that Luther was going to his death. People are like, Luther, don't go. You can't. They're going to kill you. But he's like, no, I need to go. So Luther goes to this thing. He stands before the council. They bring out all of his books. They put them in front of him, and they said, will you recant what you wrote in these? If not, you know, you're going to die. So Luther requests one day to think about it. He says, let me pray about this. I need time. So he goes away. The next day, they come back. All right, Luther, all your books, will you recant? And there's this really famous popular scene where Luther, he kind of gives him this really measured answer. He says, well, here's the deal, guys. A lot of these books are about just Christian piety. I wrote these just about, you know, you and your relationship with Jesus. You don't want me to recant those, do you? Well, no. He said, well, some of these books are about problems in the church that I don't think the Pope should be stealing money. Do you want me to recant that? Is that, do you disagree that, are you denying that there isn't some bad thing? No, that's not really right. Well, other than these books, I admit that I can be a little brash. I can say some mean stuff, and I am willing to apologize for that. And honestly, so here's what he says. Luther says to the emperor, to everybody else, he said, if anyone in this room can show me the error in these books, I will take them and I will throw them on the fire myself. As long as you prove it using the Bible. If you can show me where I'm in error from the scriptures, I will burn these books myself. Well, nobody could. Nobody even in the room probably had half of his knowledge of the Bible. And they knew that. So he refused to recant. So the scene then unfolds where essentially they're like, they say, Luther, you can go home and we're going to decide your fate. So they put him in a carriage to go home. While he's on the carriage, armed men take his carriage and he disappears. Everybody with a brain just thinks, oh, he's dead, right? The church didn't want to burn him because they want to make him a martyr, so they just killed him. Turns out that's not what happened. What actually happened was one of the princes of Germany had become a Lutheran, agreed with everything he said. And he sent some men to go and capture Luther before the church could kill him. He brought him into his castle and hid him upstairs. They had him grow a long beard, pretended he was a knight, and he lived in this German castle for a number of years when everyone thought he was dead. During that time, he took the Bible and did something crazy with it, crazy for them. Wyclef translated the Bible into English, like word for word for word. The Wyclef Bible is impossible to read. it's old English, but it's really hard to read. Luther said, I'm not just going to translate the Bible. I'm going to make it readable for Germans. It was the first time a Bible hadn't just been translated, but it almost, maybe the word you might use is paraphrase. Like it wasn't like King James, it was more like NLT, if that makes sense to you. So the whole time he's sort of hiding out, he translates the Bible into a way that any normal German could read at this point. And of course that hits the presses. And while Luther's hiding, the Bible just spreads everywhere. And this is like at the beginning, Luther definitely would have called himself a magisterial reformer. He didn't want to break up the church. He just wanted to reform. Eventually, though, it's over. It's a complete break. They've kicked him out. He said, forget you guys. The church fought hard to suppress him. Eventually, he marries a nun, which was like the end of it. Like when he married a nun, it was like, okay, you're done. So it's a total break. And now that you have a total break, you have two sides. You have people who are like, no, I'm committed to the church. And you have people who say, no, I believe Luther, but Luther's not part of the church, so what are we? What am I if I'm not part of the church, right? Now we're in this like weird, I don't know, am I going to hell? I'm not part of the church, right? What do we even call us? And this had huge political implications because the German emperor needed the German princes to support him because all the rise of nationalism. It wasn't enough just to have the Pope. And he was fighting a war. So he actually let Luther, he heard that Luther was alive. He said, you know what? You can stay, you can live, come out of hiding. It's okay, because all these princes like you, I'm going to let them go. But then when the war ended, he tried to get him again and kill him. He brought him on charges. And when he brought him on charges, all the German princes showed up to the emperor and said, we're fighting for Luther. Don't kill him. They created something called the Augsburg Confession. Why does this matter? What they did was they basically sat down and they wrote up their beliefs. They said, they didn't use the word Lutheran then, but as followers of Luther, here's what we believe. We want you to essentially legalize this belief. Let us kind of do our own thing over here, following Luther's model, the Augsburg Confession. Charles said, not a chance. He condemned it as heresy. He told him to recant. And then another war broke out with France. And it was almost like the princes at this point knew they had him. So they went to him and said, we're not going to support your war unless you sign the Augsburg Confession. And we don't quite know how this happened, but essentially they said, at some point the word was used, we're going to protest your war. In protest, we will not send you any soldiers. We'll not support you at all. We're protesting your war unless you basically let us start our own church kind of thing. So they became known as the protesters. And that would eventually be a word that we still use today, Protestants. A Protestant is someone who's followed this protest going all the way back to Luther. Rye City is a Protestant church. Protesters. We're protesting, kind of we're protesting the Catholic Church, but really we're protesting against the freedom to not worship how we want to worship. And so this became known as the Protestant Reformation, started by Martin Luther, and it would have just sweeping impact. The overall impact of the Reformation is still being felt. I mean, it was 500 years ago. Within the first 30 or 40 years, it was extreme, especially a lot of bad stuff was done. A war broke out between Protestants and Catholics. 100,000 people were killed. But essentially, the ideas began to go out. And once, kind of that old phrase like Pandora's box, right? Once you open it, you can't put it back in. You had guys like Wycliffe and John and others, Huss, that were kind of saying things and then being shut up. No more. No one was being shut up anymore. So now that the Augsburg Confession had been signed, you now had a nation, Germany, where it was fully legal and supported to not be Catholic, to have your own church, the Lutheran church now. Well, if he can have a church, we want a church too. It just started to spread. And you would have other people at the same time who had similar experiences that would start kind of their own movements. People all over the world started following Luther's example. Their anger and the stuff they were holding against the church, they could now voice it and they could actually act on it. You could now break away without getting burned at the stake. It was like the church was weak and now it was the time to act. So this would just really blow up. I want to give you a couple of people, and these names aren't quite as important. Luther's a big one. But just give you some perspective. Another famous guy at the time was Ulrich Zwingli. Ulrich was a Swiss reformer. So similar to Luther. Where he was very different, though, is he was extremely intellectual, and he was a humanist. He also was very strict, so he didn't let music in the church, and people had to be very, like, very by the book, very intellectual. And Zwingli started something called Reformed theology. You know, if we were in a different class, we'd really get into that. But Zwingli would have some long-lasting followers. The people that really were his followers would eventually be called Puritans because they were very strict. Today, Zwingli's followers are predominantly like Presbyterians. Denominations that tend to be very intellectual, sometimes a little more stoic. He was another follower. In Switzerland at the time, Switzerland was just a bunch of warring warlord states, and he converted his entire city-state, and all the other city-states didn't like it and went to war against him and killed him. But before he died, he had converted so many people that eventually Switzerland, that whole area, eventually more and more became reformed. So when you hear the word reformed, and this is a good way to understand where we're at today. You might hear that phrase like, that's reformed or this is reformed. In some ways, and I know this is confusing, in some ways, anybody who calls himself a Protestant, which is almost all Christians in America, Catholics, is sort of kind of reformed. But reformed is also a very specific kind of Protestant. Reformed churches have a different, their own kind of view on a lot of issues. What those issues are would become more and more clear when Zwingli's ideas sort of got formulated by his, not only his successor, but a guy that came after him, who was even more famous. Zwingli's ideas were really picked up by a brilliant man named John Calvin. You ever heard the phrase Calvinism? John Calvin was like a big deal. Calvin was a book nerd, quiet, shy guy, born in France. He learned about the Protestant movement through a group of French known as the Huguenots, and he was really influenced by them, and they kind of converted him. And he wrote this whole book defending the Huguenots who were being persecuted and killed in France, because France was very Catholic. But no one in France would publish his book because it was like heresy. And so he knew he had to leave because he wanted to get published. So he went to Switzerland, interacted with Zwingli and stuff. And he was a sensation because people there loved his knowledge, Scholasticism, he was a brilliant mind. They were hearing all this stuff happening in Germany with Luther. And now we got a guy here, Calvin's our guy. There was a German pastor who was doing some stuff and asked him to come and write for him. And Calvin didn't like attention. He was invited to come and just be a scholar somewhere and just sit in home and read books and write. Like, I want to do that. So he's like, that's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to go and be a scholar and get away from people. And so he travels to Strasbourg. And on his way, he has to get detoured because of a border skirmish. And he actually spends the night in a little town called Geneva. And while he's there at that night, there's a local like Christian leader who's now he's a part of the Reformation movement. Who's like, John Calvin, you're like, we heard of you. You're like really a big deal. Will you stay here and help us be our pastor? And Calvin never left Geneva. He spent the rest of his life there. He became the head of the church in Geneva. He didn't want it, but he took it. And he basically almost all of Switzerland, Sweden, the Netherlands, Holland, all of that area now is predominantly Calvinist. It really formed the whole movement. Whereas Germans are predominantly Lutheran. They're all Reformed, but they kind of, you're going to forget most of what I just said. But the idea, though, is I want you to see one thing. In 800 years, there had been one thing. In 20 years, there's now three things. In 50 years later, there'd be 20 things. In America, there's how many? I don't even know. As soon as the break started happening, it just fractured like glass. And you suddenly had all these different movements, different groups going different ways. He would stay there the rest of his life. You can read Calvin. He had a lot to say. He wrote something called The Institutes of Christian Religion, which you can read today. And I wouldn't recommend it. It bored the crumb out of me. And it's like five books. He was the first person to do, we have this phrase in academic Christian circles called systematic theology, where we like, almost like an encyclopedia, we take ideas and we write about them. And his book is like an encyclopedia. You know, it takes an idea like sin and eternity. One of John Calvin's big ideas was this idea of predestination. All those guys, Zwingli, Calvin, that whole area believe very strongly that God decides in advance who's in. That's not your decision. Luther was like, I don't know about that. It seems like I have a say. And of course, they fought and broke up and weren't friends. But basically, today, Calvinists are often defined as strong people who believe in predestination. And here in America, you know, there's some Calvinists, there's some non-Calvinists. Like, it's all fractured and different. So when you meet people who are from different denominations, maybe some in here, probably different denominations. Rise City, I've said this before, and I say it again. Rise City is what I like to call a theological mutt. Like, it's like, what is Rise City? We don't know. We just all kind of born together. We all believe in things. But at this time, this is all, everything's just fracturing. People are taking sides, different groups. There's arguments about how much Calvin actually cared about predestination, but his name really got attached to it. And questions of free will would become like big questions. Some of us today would be like, why is that a big deal? It was a big deal. They fought over it. But if you were in part one of our church history class, you know humans like to fight over things that aren't big deals. Calvin and some other things. Calvin also got very political. He talked about how God requires obedience to governments. However, if the government is not doing what it should or violating God's laws, you can disobey. So guess who loved John Calvin in 1776? Our traitorous rebel grandparents. Calvin really set the groundwork for nations to start breaking off and things like that, and using God as an excuse to do it. Now, as I mentioned, neither Zwingli nor Luther wanted to break from the church. They just wanted to reform it. But there were a lot of people who radically were opposed to it. Like I said, the radical reformers felt there wasn't enough, pushed for a break from the church. And I want to introduce you to one group of people for our last 5 minutes. Good time here. We're good. And let me set this up. I might go 1 minute longer. That's okay. In the church of the Middle Ages, if you were part of the church, you were a Christian. And if you're part of this kind of Christianity, that sounds strange. It's like, well, shouldn't Christianity be your own decision? Well, we are descendants of the people who thought that way. But at the time, no, if you're in the church, you're a Christian, period. What if you're a terrible person? Doesn't matter, you're in the church. You go to purgatory. How do you know you're in the church? Two things. Number one, as an infant, you were baptized, which meant you were brought into the church. Your parents baptized you, a priest did it, you're good. Number two, you take the sacraments. You regularly take the communion, you take confession, you got married in the church, you're buried in the church. We talked about that in part one. Those two things, baptism, into the church, and then the priest giving you what you need to do to stay in. As long as that happens, doesn't matter how you live your life, doesn't really matter what you believe, what you think, what you do, doesn't matter, you're a Christian, you're going to go to heaven. When all of this starts to happen, when all these fractures start taking place, there were people, I don't want to say they started thinking differently, there were people arguing this for a long time, now had the freedom to say it out loud, started saying, hold on a second, we're reading this for ourselves, and it doesn't say that. It says that you have to choose this. You have to decide you want to follow Jesus. Just a priest giving me a cracker doesn't mean a Christian. Being baptized as a baby doesn't mean anything. I need to choose this. It needs to be something I choose to love God myself. That's what made me a Christian. So here's what we're going to do. We are going to show that we reject that whole system, and we are going to go get baptized again. We're going to get a new baptism. If you called Anna New Baptists. Anabaptists were people who rejected the church. And they were radical reformers who said, we don't just want to fix it. We're leaving it. We're done with it. Like, the whole concept that you call Catholic, whatever, we want nothing to do with it. And the reason that we're going to show that we want nothing to do with it, we don't care if you excommunicate us, because you don't have the power to save us. It's my faith in Jesus that saves me. So I'm going to go get baptized for myself. So how do you think the church leaders felt about that? Not great. They were extreme biblicists who took the scriptures literally. So a lot of the Zwingli, Calvin, those guys, the people that follow Luther himself wasn't this way, but all of his followers were completely broke from the church. Although because Luther liked a lot of parts of the church, Lutherans today still do a lot of things that look a little Catholic. In fact, Lutherans still baptize infants. But people that followed Anabaptists didn't. Most of the people that would eventually, we'll see this in week three, made their way to America were Anabaptists. And so most American Christianity are like, I am absolutely what you might call an Anabaptist. I don't use that word because it doesn't mean anything in my culture. But 400 years ago, I would absolutely label myself an Anabaptist. I believe the church does not save me. Jesus saves me, and that's my decision. The Anabaptists stood up and said, this is what we believe. If you lived in Germany, okay, if you lived in Germany and you were part of Luther's crew, I guess you might say it, this was okay. It was cool, whatever. The princes are for you. The German emperor, he already signed the Augsburg Confession. You're okay. In fact, if you disagreed with Luther and you wanted to stay Catholic, it was actually worse for you, because now the Lutherans are in power. And what do people do when they're in power? They oppress the people that aren't. It just keeps going in a circle. So a lot of Catholics got persecuted in Germany. If you lived in Switzerland and you wanted to follow Zwingli or Calvin and be an Anabaptist, good. You're good to go. If you live in France, nope. The king of France is a staunch Catholic. If you live in Spain, not a chance. So what happens if you come out and say you're an Anabaptist in France? They kill you. And so the Anabaptists were the most persecuted group in the first 100 years or so of the Reformation. The Anabaptists were extremely persecuted, constantly killed, and they would be essentially, and this is going to turn into this, it's inevitable, and we'll probably week three, we'll really dive into it. because they were so heavily persecuted, because these people were like, especially like in France and in England, it was, this is bad. You're an Anabaptist. Oh, terrible. You can't marry my daughter. Kill that person. Like, it was really bad. Anywhere outside of Germany and like what today is like Holland and Switzerland, the rest of Europe, like Anabaptists are bad. You can be a reformer, but not an Anabaptist. What do we do? Do we keep hiding in caves and whatever? I've heard that on the other side of the ocean, they discovered a land that we could go to and we could start our own country that we can believe and worship however we want. And the Anabaptists were the first people to get on boats and come over here, hearing that they could be Anabaptists and no one would kill them for it. So most early Americans were Anabaptists. So that is the beginnings of the Reformation. It is not all the Reformation. This is a three-week class. Because while all of this is happening, and a word you're going to hear a lot next week is the word continent. You know what a continent is, obviously. When I say continent, we have this word, we say continental reformers. Big word. What we mean by that is people who are on the continent of Europe. So whether you're in Germany or France or Spain, right, like all these people are coming together. There were a bunch of people, though, that were not on the continent of Europe. They were off on their own little island that we call England. And the people in England also experienced the Reformation at the same time, right? But their little island off in the corner was actually very, very different. They experienced Reformation, but it was completely different. And the way it happened was different, and the outflowing it would happen was different. So everything I just talked about was like Germany, especially, again, Switzerland, Sweden, Holland, that whole area, and it would definitely influence France and Spain eventually. But something else happened in Europe, or in England, that would became known as the English Reformation. And the big famous character of the English Reformation was a man by the name of Henry VIII. I'm Henry VIII, I am. Henry VIII had a few wives. And the reason we need to talk about the English Reformation is, again, a lot of Anabaptists came to America, right? But who really founded America was the English, right? We have our roots in England. And so the English Reformation would have a massive, massive implications for the next 200, 300 years and impact America incredibly. So we'll touch on Luther here and there again, but for the most part, that happened in Germany. At the same time, next week, we're going to look at what happened in England, and then we'll take a step forward and look at the way that it affected the next 200 or 300 years. In week three, we'll probably get to about the 1900s pretty quickly, and then we're going to spend a little time looking at some of the different ways that these different splinter groups believe different things. The reason I want to do that is because often we have questions about, well, why does that denomination believe this? And what's different about that denomination? This is a good class to be like, so these people went over here and became Methodists, and these people became Episcopalians, and we're kind of going to see where all these different groups go. And so hopefully today, when you meet people who say, oh, I'm a whatever, Southern Baptist, what does that mean? I come from this group. And yes, Southern Baptists are Anabaptists for sure. They were Baptists who didn't like baptism, so they created their, they didn't like the Baptist moniker, so they created their own hipper, cooler version, called it Southern Baptist. We're getting that. We're going to talk about that. It's fun. I love that stuff. So that was 802. Okay, right? Some of you guys are Southern Baptists. You like to see? No. I like Southern Baptists. I'm all for them. Okay, guys, we'll see you next week and talk about Henry VIII.